Jesus Christ was a man that traveled through the land, carpenter true and brave. Said to the rich, give your goods to the poor, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Jesus was a man, a carpenter by hand.
Welcome to, what are we again? Oh yes, this is the Republic of Canada show. And I am Kevin Annett back after a week of illness. I had stomach flu and it hasn't been the greatest, but I'm back as always with my friend and co-host Ryan Gable. We're back here every Sunday, 6 p.m. on Radio Free Canada. And that was Woody Guthrie singing song about our friend and comrade Jesus Christ and how he's embodied in so many of us who are struggling to reclaim the world for all the people, whether it's in Canada or America or anywhere in the world. And we welcome your comments and your involvement. We appreciate the growing number of listeners. And today we're going to carry on with our discussion of how we reclaim the world in a what's essentially a spiritual battle, but it has many physical manifestations. I'm going to start with a news item that Ryan just sent me today. And it's a topic close to home, especially in light of Jorge Bergoglio, a.k.a. Pope Francis's visit to America, where he's going to canonize a murderous man named Junipero Serra, who oversaw the murder of many thousands of California Indians on slave plantations run by the Catholic Church. Apparently that deserves beatification in the mind of Pope Francis, that great liberal. But anyway, in Sacramento, California, which is actually the capital of the state, there's a news article that came out this week, and this should be of particular interest to a group of ours in Sacramento that's organizing events at the end of August. I'm sorry, at the end of October, where I'll be speaking. So this is sending out to all you folks in Sacramento, especially Indigenous activists. The article is entitled, History Professor Denies Native Genocide, Native Student Disagrees and Gets Expelled from Course. A Cal State Sacramento University professor who allegedly told his U.S. history class he did not like the term genocide in relation to Native Americans in history told a Native American student who disagreed with him that she was disenrolled and expelled from the course. This account is according to Native student Chinaba Johnson, a 19-year-old sophomore student from Navajo and Maidu ancestry. Johnson says when she told her U.S. history professor Maury Wiseman that she disagreed with his assessment that Native Americans did not face genocide, the professor said she was, quote, hijacking his class and that she was accusing him of bigotry and racism. The professor then dismissed the class early, apologized for Johnson's disruptions, and told her she was disenrolled at the end of the class on Friday, although the college is claiming that she hasn't been disenrolled. We're going to post this up online. People can read the details. But the point is that this is not unusual. This kind of Holocaust denial goes on routinely across North America, even though the massive evidence now is out there. Some of it, just share with you briefly. This is, of course, posted up at itccs.org and hiddennolonger.com, where we have a lot of this extensive evidence of genocide. But, you know, with the three-minute memory these days and the constant denial of this by the corporate media, we have to keep reminding people of these facts. Here's a few quotes. This is from the founder of one of the founders of British Columbia, Sir Edward Bulwer Lytton, spoken in 1868 when he's helping establish the Legislative Assembly just up the coast from California. Colonization is civilization. If we, the superior race, take the land of other races, we must utterly destroy the previous inhabitants, unquote. And this professor, Maury Wiseman, when he was expelling this young Native girl from his class, claimed that we didn't try to kill the Natives. They died naturally from diseases. Well, here's a quote from John McLean, who was a Hudson's Bay Company trader and land speculator, about his first trips among the Chilcotin Indians on the West Coast and published in a book called Only in Nazco, which was written in 1908. John McLean said, quote, I just got a blanket well infected with smallpox, carefully put it between a saddle blanket and a sweat pad, and I succeeded. All the Chilcotins died of smallpox, unquote. And these kind of quotes carry on and on of the deliberate infection of natives with smallpox and tuberculosis. And even recently, the government of Canada and the churches acknowledging that, yes, one of the primary means of children dying in the residential schools was through deliberate infection with tuberculosis and then never treating the sick and making them sleep with the healthy. So some of this evidence has been talked about a lot. We are going to be make a point of visiting the Cal State Sacramento University and speaking to this professor and student and hopefully organizing symposiums there in November when we're present, holding these other events in Sacramento. I'll talk about that more in a little bit, but let me just bring on Ryan and ask for his comments. Welcome, Ryan.
Hey, Kevin. How are you doing today?
I'm just fine, despite the illness.
Well, I hope you feel better. I've actually been feeling pretty well recently. I saw this article I thought it would be great to talk about on the show, Shitanaba Johnson, a Navajo native at the university in Sacramento, 19 years old, and basically she is, I guess she's expelled because she disagrees with the U.S. history professor, Mari Wiseman, who says that genocide did not occur, that basically she was hijacking the class for even suggesting this. And I mean, this really goes against the foundational principles for what universities are supposed to be. It should be an open forum to have a discussion, even if you disagree. And what we're seeing more and more are colleges beginning to lock down that discussion so only the official version of events gets told.
It's interesting. There's a law in Austria that if you deny the genocide of Jews in Europe, it's a criminal offense to even deny it in writing or speaking, and you can go to jail. In fact, various scholars have faced prison terms for denying the Jews were killed as a genocidal act. Well, a lot more people died on this side of the water from the genocide here than did during that 12-year period during 20th century history in Europe, and yet this is not considered genocide. And in fact, if the same law were applied here, a lot of politicians and academics would go to jail for denying the Aboriginal genocide and Holocaust.
Yeah, and instead of that, we have basically a whitewash every time the official history is told. Even when we do get an admission such as the TRC, it's always kind of put up against this brick wall of, okay, it happened, you guys were right, but it wasn't as bad as you said it was. And you see this kind of argument with public relation firms, whether it was Big Tobacco or the lead industry, they always come out from the beginning and say, there's no harm going to be caused by our products. And that's the same kind of a thing with genocide. Genocide didn't occur. And then eventually when the evidence comes out that the products are harmful or genocide obviously did occur and you can't deny it, it's, well, the products could be harmful, but they won't harm you. Well, genocide did occur, but it didn't affect you. And eventually the argument forms into, okay, the products are harmful. We lied to you, but don't worry. They're not as harmful as we say they are. Genocide is admitted. Okay, it did happen. It did happen to the natives. And, well, it wasn't as bad as other people like Kevin or Ryan said it was. And it just is that kind of cognitive dissonance.
Right. And, you know, to put this in context as well with what's happening today, as we've mentioned before, Pope Francis Jorge Bergoglio arrives in America September 22nd. He flies into Washington, D.C. And even before he speaks to Congress, that next day on the 23rd at 4 p.m., he's canonizing Junipero Serra. Now, Serra was a Franciscan missionary who led the Spanish invasion of California. He was accompanied with conquistador soldiers in the this was in the last third of the 18th century. So around the 1770s, when America is being formed, Junipero Serra is out on the West Coast setting up over 20 plantations, which are really slave labor colonies. And the conquistadors would round up the Indians in an area, and they would be forced to convert to Catholicism. And if they refused, they were killed on the spot. Those who converted were instantly turned into slaves who were worked to death, men, women, and children, in their thousands by Junipero Serra. Now, this wonderful liberal who people seem to love for some reason, Pope Francis, he likes to call himself or imposes a liberal on other issues, he said the other day that, quote, Junipero Serra's zeal inspires us, unquote. Well, exactly, maybe a daring reporter would ask the Pope why he's inspired by mass murder. What aspect of working children to death on plantations inspires him exactly? Maybe he's let slip the fact that he himself is a participant in the Ninth Circle and doesn't mind the idea of children being tortured to death. Maybe that's something that could be asked by him to him at some point. But anyway, I think it illustrates how this whole issue of genocide is not something in the past. It's continuing. And the Catholic Church is continuing to uphold its position, including Pope Francis is upholding this position, that there was nothing wrong with doing this to non-Catholics. And in fact, it's still their position that if you're not a Catholic, you're not worthy of life. It's that simple.
That was an interesting kind of association they gave to pagans as well, trying to convert them or during the Inquisition, is that they would say that these people are heathens, which by definition is absolutely ridiculous, because the definition of heathen means without a god. And many pagans had multiple gods, or they worshiped the foundational principles for which the church was actually built, for which the church no longer operates on. I find it interesting what you're saying basically is how a lot of U.S. politicians operate, or politicians all over the world, where Hillary Clinton, who's running for president now, she says that she admires people like Margaret Sanger, who was a known eugenicist. She would speak at KKK Klan rallies. She said that everybody from Hebrews to blacks were like weeds that needed to be exterminated. And then Hillary Clinton comes out and says she greatly admires Margaret Sanger. And of course, Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, a eugenics organization with funding and help from the Bush family. And when you look at the connections with everything that we always talk about, just recently, Kevin, and we talk about this on my show, The Secret Teachings, all of the time. Recently, Bergoglio, Pope Francis, comes out and he says now, I think it was about 4 days ago, he is now going to give all priests across the world the ability from God to forgive women for abortions. I don't find that to be a coincidence, seeing that 9 videos have been released from the Center for Medical Progress showing the relationship between companies like ABR and Stem Express and the selling of aborted fetal tissue and the chopping up of babies to sell them on the black market and for medical research and experimentation, which is what happened with a lot of the natives. They were experimented on and then exterminated. I don't see this as a coincidence. What are your thoughts?
Well, no, and as a matter of fact, what it says to me is this whole posing by the Catholic Church that they're, quote, pro-life has been a farce all along and a posturing, because in practice, we know, first of all, they haven't been consistently pro-life at all. They traffic children. They murder children. They had a policy, and I'm known this talking to eyewitnesses like Helen Michelle, who is a Native woman in central British Columbia, who gave testimony at our first tribunal in the summer of 1998 in Vancouver. She said that when she was made pregnant by a priest, they aborted the baby right away. That was in a Catholic school in Kamloops, British Columbia. So it's, you know, kind of very selective pro-life policy. In reality, the very fact that Bergoglio could make a statement like that and not be denounced from one end of the Catholic Church or the other, nobody's raised a peep about it in the Catholic Church. I thought they were pro-life, quote, in quotes, right? So, I mean, it shows you that the mask is really slipping on this, you know, this oldest, most murderous organization on the planet, the Vatican, the Roman Catholic Church. And people are seeing what they really stand for now. And this is why it's really an amazing opportunity now for people to stand up and say, okay, look, this is a criminal body. They're proving it in practice over and over. Why are we standing back? Why are we not enforcing this arrest warrant against these top officials, including Bergoglio, shutting down their churches, seizing their funds, occupying the buildings? It's not a problem of not knowing, you know, what the issue is. It's a problem of people's fear of doing it. And that's, that's a whole other issue we can talk about.
Well, they also try to make Bergoglio look like this great reformer. And when there are contradictions in policy and the Catholic faith and the standpoint of the Vatican for centuries, it's like, well, Bergoglio, he's a great reformer. Look, this guy's paying his own hotel bill. You know, he's changing the church for the betterment. And as the information comes out and as it's obvious what the Vatican and what the church and what Bergoglio and all of the other priests are involved in, and all of the other connections as well, with politics and business and things like that, and the banks, you find out that as the information comes out, Kevin, they try to spin it like a public relations firm and says, okay, even though Bergoglio now says we can forgive women, it's not about pro-life, they try to spin it and make it look like what I said a second ago, that he's a great reformer and that he's making a change for the better. I mean, to me, it just sounds like a lot of rhetoric and trying to alter people's perception and use the momentum to alter the situation and just not make it seem as bad as it really is to divert people's attention from what's really going on.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, it's just a classic spin operation. They just have more money and, exactly. and media access than your typical corporation in damage control. And that's why so many people believe it, because they see it on Time magazine. So they, you know, 85% of people believe what they see. And, you know, what I wanted to mention, too, is that related to this canonization that's happening on September 23rd in D.C. is the fact that that night, we have a lot of evidence to suggest that there will be a Ninth Circle ritual occurring in D.C. at one of the two churches, either at the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception, where the canonization is happening, or...
And we speculated on this last week, too, Kevin. I believe I mentioned this to you last week on the show.
Right. Now, this is more than speculation, though. It's either going to be at that Basilica or at St. Patrick's Cathedral in D.C. Now, first of all, we know that the 23rd, 24th is a high point of these sacrificial rites. We all know that Bergoglio, as well as an active member of the Ninth Circle, from eyewitnesses. Thirdly, we know that one of the sources for Native children being trafficked and killed in America are the Navajo and Apache reserves, especially the Gila Reserve. We have that from an insider, a woman in the Satanic networks who we've helped to document where a lot of these sources of you know, the children being abducted and killed are coming from. And it's interesting, I found that this young girl who was thrown out of the class is herself Navajo. So, I mean, you know, these things are kind of hitting the nerves of the system reacts. And we are saying to people seriously that when those in D.C. who are protesting this have to do more than protest. We've got to go to the sites of these churches that night and stop these sacrificial ceremonies from happening. These are not idle, you know, paranoid speculations. These are from eyewitnesses like Toast Nienhaus, Anne-Marie von Billenberg, and others in America who've seen these rituals occurring. And they, you know, if you like, the symbolic canonization or the glorification of genocide, if you like, that goes on in that service is going to be literally enacted that night through the ceremonial bloodletting of another Native child in the ceremony. So again, people have to be aware of the seriousness of this. This isn't mere protest we're talking about.
Again, I think I've mentioned this several times, Kevin. If you look at the wheel of the year, which is the 8 sabbats, there are major and minor sabbats, comes from the origins of Wiccan and pagan belief systems, which the church essentially was established on, taking and distorting the teachings of Jesus and ignoring the Gnostic Gospels and others. The 23rd of September, the 20th to the 23rd, is actually Mabon, which is the fall equinox, the midpoint between the summer solstice and the winter solstice, the highest and the lowest point of the sun during the year, the sun god, and that kind of astrotheology. And you find that what the church will do is that they will have these events, or the Pope will speak on at certain times, which is why I think he's coming here during the Mabon festival, because most of these sabbats call for a ritual sacrifice. Now, the pagans would sacrifice much differently than the church does. So to sacrifice to the goddess, it was a representation and sacrifice of the life-giving qualities of the female. And of course, looking at the church as kind of a masculine, physical, dominating, overt, you know, very rough, in-your-face, rigid type of belief system, rigid type of male energy, the greatest sin against God is basically the killing of a child. Because it is innocence, and because the child is the greatest gift from God in the sense that it is life-giving, the woman gives life to the child, which is why, as I mentioned before, they sacrifice these children in the underground crypts of churches and in underground caves like the Mithraic celebrations, primarily because the underground symbolizes, or the cave or the grotto symbolizes, the womb of the female, or the womb of Mother Gaia, the earth, the life-giving ability. That's why it's so important.
It reverses that life-giving force, in effect, and they figure by reversing it, they can control that power. And, yeah, I mean, this is well acknowledged by anybody who knows anything about not just the history of the Vatican, but the nature of these satanic, you know, rituals. And I also wanted to mention, somebody passed me a note that, are you aware of the fact that Madonna is on a world tour, and she's going to be appearing in D.C., in New York City, and Philadelphia right before the Pope? We've got the dates here.
I did not know that, but I know she had a song she put out recently that was very Masonic and occult in nature, a lot of the symbolism. I don't see that as being a coincidence, though. I mean, what you'll find actually, Kevin, I believe I've written a book about this called The Grand Illusion. I covered it towards the end of the book. It's like 738 pages. That a lot of these concerts and sporting events where so many people tune in, and there's so much occult type of imagery, which a lot of it is the reversed kind of archonic, demonic imagery that is the opposition of what like the original teachings of Jesus or the original cathedrals and churches were supposed to be about, the teachings of the Knights Templar, dualism, things like that. What they'll actually have is that when they have these concerts, there are sacrifices that are performed using the energy that is kind of inserted or that is absorbed into the earth from these massive 60,000 seat arenas, or, you know, like a 20,000 seat, a concert hall or something. And there's actually sacrifices that take place. I'll give you a really good example. I don't know what you think about this, but if you watch the 2012 London Olympics, they actually banned it on television, the opening ceremonies on NBC in the United States, because they said it was too strange for Americans. And what they actually had was they had an image of death, supposedly Lord Voldemort from Harry Potter, and they had him over in the ceremony of, like, I think there were like 20 or 30, maybe more than that, beds of orphan children who were being abducted, and then they brought out this giant baby as part of this symbolic sacrifice. So whether it's literal or figurative, yeah, they still can use this energy, which is why the ancients would build cathedrals, churches, and temples on these ley lines around the earth.
Well, I want to use that as a springboard to kind of the next aspect of what we're talking about, Ryan, because this is all about, as we mentioned in our article, about energy transfer and protest versus reclaiming your own power. This is about how to take back the power and energy and life being taken from us by these institutions, you know, masking as beneficent organizations. In fact, they're the source of the problem. And one of the things that that I'm finding is that when, you know, as we talked about for the last few shows, there's three aspects of what Sun Tzu calls Xi, or power or energy. There's an individual Xi, there's a collective Xi, and then there's what Sun Tzu likes to talk about in relation to a battle or politics, which is situational Xi. So, for example, he says that, and this is a when people operate totally out of their heads, they don't seem to understand this, but one of the famous quotes from Sun Tzu in the Art of War, he says, "The victorious army is first victorious and then does battle, whereas the defeated army first does battle and then seeks victory." Now, somebody says, well, how can you be victorious before you ever engage in battle? You're victorious by reclaiming the Xi of a situation, by, in effect, creating what Sun Tzu would say, you form the ground of your opponent. You form the issue and you stand on the issue and you make them respond to you. And in fact, that's how we won the whole battle to expose genocide in Canada and to expose the crimes of the Vatican. A few of us set the issue and we stood on it and we didn't budge. They had to respond no matter how big they were. That's what Sun Tzu calls about being victorious before you enter battle. And I keep trying to teach this to people and it just doesn't penetrate. People are so conditioned to handing over their Xi, their authority, their, you know, deferring at every level to the opponent that they don't know how to act in that way. So we have to go through a long period of educating people, not just in theory, but in practice, to show them how it's done. If we are to reverse this and start to reclaim this, to me, that's the way, you know, to have an impact, what, you know, some call spiritual warfare. It's really a simple question of, in a way, mental energy.
Yeah, and you have to break people out of that conventional paradigm as well. I mean, what we're doing is so unconventional. It's even unconventional to the unconventional mindset. It's a whole nother type of energy set. And, you know, it's hard enough to break people out of the matrix type mentality anyway, let alone kind of go in and present an alternative to the alternative. It takes a long time for that to kind of sink in. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but as long as we're presenting it, getting it out there, that energy will eventually spread and people will wake up and understand what's really going on. You just have to kind of inject it.
Well, we have proof of that. The only reason Bergoglio was running around the world trying to make the Vatican look good is because of exactly what we've been bringing up for the last number of years. He's proving that we're having that impact.
Pecan stepped down. Adolfo Pecan stepped down because of that.
Absolutely. There's a direct correlation. It happened within 3 weeks of him being named in our indictment of that the head of the Jesuits announced his resignation. Now, let me lead into this. There's this Phil Oakes song we're going to play at the break in a couple of minutes called Love Me, I'm a Liberal. And he was, of course, writing in the context of America in the 1960s. But when you're talking about liberal approach to politics, it's always a question of liberals will always assume that the system is basically good. It just has to be prodded to do the right thing. And we're finding that the exact opposite is the truth. In fact, when a system is systemically evil and destructive, you don't parley with it, you bring it down. And that's, we're talking about various ways of doing that. And after the break, after the song, we're going to talk about, you know, some examples of how we're doing that now and ways that people can begin this process. We'll get into that after the break. So let's play that song now, come back and talk more about this.
In every American community, you have varying shades of political opinion. One of the shadiest of these is the liberals. An outspoken group on many subjects. 10 degrees to the left of center in good times. 10 degrees to the right of center if it affects them personally.
Ah, yes. How true. How so very true.
It's a great song.
I love it. Good old Phil Oakes. He was quite the guy, and he always was out there on the front lines. And he died suddenly in 1975 of a, quote, suicide, a drug overdose, even though he didn't take drugs. But the point is, these songs and spirit live on in all of us. I wanted to share a quote, and it's from the very first verse of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5. It says, when Jesus saw the multitude, he went up into a mountain. And when he was set, his disciples came to him, and Jesus opened his mouth and taught them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for they shall be, theirs is the kingdom of heaven, etc. Now, what I find interesting about that, he's not speaking to most people. Like, here's this multitude. He's just fed with bread, the miracles of the loaves and fishes. He's just healed all of them. He's fed them. But he doesn't speak to them the secret knowledge, the secret teachings, if you like, Ryan. He turns to his disciples and says, teaches them what the Gnostics call the secret wisdom or teachings. Now, that's something the church tries to brainwash out of people. They're always saying these teachers come for everybody. But the truth is, no, they don't, because they know that most people cannot receive it. Jesus knew, like any good organizer knows, that most people are not going to be stirred by ideas. They're going to be stirred by being healed, by receiving bread. They're going to go with the majority. Our message is not for most people. It's for those who have already, to some degree, awoken and have the stamina and the guts to carry the struggle on. And those are the ones who we're speaking to. And I want to say that because a lot of us can get demoralized after a while in this work by saying, oh my God, nobody's responding. You know, I tried to go out there and I got heckled and nobody, you know, we're getting so few hits on the internet. Folks, I mean, this is not about many people. We didn't need many people to turn Canada around on the genocide stuff or to bring down Pope Benedict. That wasn't caused by numbers. That was caused by spirit and resolve. So this message is going out to those few out there who really hear it and are able to put it into practice and have the spirit to act on it. What do you think, Ryan?
I think that's exactly right. And as a matter of fact, if you look at Ratzinger, who stepped down during the hearings of the ICLCJ and what you did with the ITCCS, and you find out that the United Nations actually got involved in talking about the abuse of children by the Vatican, saying that Vatican policy, crimen solicitanus, says that priests have to cover up child pedophiles. And they didn't use that terminology, Kevin, but a couple of years ago, that was like a year, maybe 2 years ago, the UN actually said Vatican policy, there's a news article in RT and some other news sites, allows priests to molest children. And as that came out, Ratzinger, as he when he stepped down, the Vatican also announced that the reason, and this is absolute proof that our movement, as small as it might seem, has such a dramatic impact on the world, the Vatican announced that the reason that Ratzinger stepped down, they say, well, he retired, he couldn't handle it anymore, but the reason he's living in Vatican City now, because it's a sovereign state, not subject really to outside rule, and they have so much money and wealth and power and influence, is because they know if he leaves, he will be tried for the trafficking of children. Now, that's a statement from the Vatican. I mean, at the minimal, why would they make a statement like that if that wasn't the real reason why he stepped down and why he can't leave Vatican City to this day? And most people don't know that.
Yeah, and they also don't know the fact that 5 days before he resigned, the Secretary of State, Cicio Bertone, who also then stepped down after that, Bertone got a diplomatic note from the Spanish government saying, we are considering issuing an arrest warrant against Ratzinger if he comes on Spanish territory, because Spain is the only country in the world that claims universal jurisdiction in their courts over any human rights case. So they could try Ratzinger, put him on trial, and he knew it, so he resigned. The Spanish government had already received our evidence of Ratzinger's direct role in trafficking children and covering up and protecting even his own brother who had raped children. So these warrants, these court cases have an impact. Even if most people don't know this, the Vatican knows that our verdicts can be acted upon by other courts and other courts can issue arrest warrants. So, you know.
That's why they react the way they do and try to spin the story.
That's right. So that's proving to people that we have the power. You don't need any more proof from us. You know, the evidence is all there. We've shown that it works. Now, the question is, you know, how do we carry this on? And one of the things that we do all the time is we start training people in these methods, in the spirit and methodology. You know, I want to share with you another little brilliant little story I heard about to show you kind of the things that can help inspire us. There was a guy, he wrote a book. He was a special forces colonel who was one of the first, quote, advisors sent to Vietnam by Kennedy in the early 60s. He described an incident early on where he was an advisor in a helicopter crew that was going after the local Viet Cong. And these South Vietnamese pilots were strafing this one Viet Cong platoon. What the U.S. colonel saw was the commander of that platoon turned to cover the escape of his men. He stood in front of the helicopter, aimed his rifle, and was taking on the helicopter single-handedly. So the Vietnamese land the helicopter to try to capture this guy. The NLF, the Viet Cong commander, runs over, grabs onto the bottom of the helicopter, and starts fighting them individually. They take off to try to shake this guy loose, and he won't let go. They finally shoot him, but the colonel says in his memoirs, he sent a special memo to Washington saying, if all of the Viet Cong are like him, we are going to lose this war, because he had the courage and the resolve that the South Vietnamese didn't have, hiding behind their guns and everything. This man gave his life to protect his platoon, and if all the Viet Cong are like that, we've lost this war. He said that in 1962, and sure enough, they lost. So it all shows that it comes down to spirit, that fighting spirit. Now, where is that among us? Where are the people among us who are willing to grab the system like that and pull it down? And, you know, I know there are us out there listening who are like that. My message to all of us who are listening is it's time now to act. We don't have a lot of time left. This is not just about trafficked children. The system is bringing us all down. And unless we grab onto the system like that man did to the helicopter and try to yank it down, we're not going to be here. So I just wanted to share that story and to keep urging people to be inspired, to have that kind of fighting spirit.
Well, it's a great story to also show how one person, I mean, look how one person can influence history, can influence a situation to that extent. That means that one individual, you, Kevin, me, we can have such a great influence. Imagine just getting a couple more people, as you have shown, occupying churches. I actually have a story, another news article I thought was very relevant to what we're talking about, and actually I might be able to tie it in with the story you just told. When you look, when a country occupies another country, and they commit genocide. Look at when the United States first went into Afghanistan and Iraq. The first thing they did was actually go to the libraries. They destroyed books. They burnt libraries down. They stole art. Yes, some of it was sold in the market, but a lot of it was destroyed. So they destroyed the people's culture, and then they instilled this image of democracy with American ideals, however corrupt they are, and they began to brainwash the future generations of those countries so they grow up with a type of Western mindset. And of course, all those countries now are in tremendous amounts of debt to central banks that they didn't have prior to the invasion. Now, I wanted to couple that with the fact that those wars were fought on a lie. And there's a news article out right now, and I want to present this to people so they can get an idea of how to look through the manipulation, Kevin. This article says, college brainwashes students into believing 9/11 was our fault. I'm not going to get into 9/11, but I wanted to just explain this story. Apparently, there's a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, who has a curriculum that teaches that 9/11 is the result of American imperialism, and this goes for any imperialistic nation or ideology. And what this guy teaches, his name is an English professor, his name is Neil Ahuja, and he specializes in post-colonial studies. He says that Americans' depictions of the 9/11 terrorists as, quote, monsters, and this ties in perfectly with Native genocide, Kevin. He says that the depiction of these terrorists as, quote, monsters is an attempt to, quote, animalize them as insects and justify, quote, squashing them in a fantasy of justice. That is exactly the type of mentality and ideology that is put into troops, soldiers, that is put into the occupying force of any nation to justify the slaughtering of the innocent.
Well, exactly. It's the whole genocidal mentality. And what I find really interesting is over the years working on this stuff, you don't really need that many people. You know, there's an old saying by Krishnamurti, the Hindu philosopher. He said, it only takes one man to commit a crime, but a whole community to cover it up. And the issue for me has always been the fact that what is it in the majority population which allows people to know, they all almost know instinctively when to turn away, when to look the other way, and how to go about concealing a crime, knowing they're concealing it, yet lying to themselves that they're not. And, you know, we often found this when you talked about occupying churches. There's this big fear element when people go into occupied church. But what you find when you walk through that door and you just walk to the front and you make a statement to everyone in the congregation, or when you occupy it, is that they are more scared than you are. They know they're guilty. Those priests in there that day we occupied Holy Rosary Cathedral in Vancouver, they knew they were guilty and they were on the defensive. It's just like, you know, when we talk about taking the she of a much larger enemy, the reason we're able to do that when it has to do with the Vatican or the Canadian government or anywhere in America where these crimes are going on is that they know they're guilty, so they're extremely defensive. And a single act by us, which normally against a non-guilty party wouldn't have an effect, against the guilty, it invokes an amazing counter-reaction. They start admitting things. They start panicking. They start killing themselves, you know. And so that's part of the old saying that Sun Tzu had is that, actually, if you goad your enemy, their reaction is stronger than anything you can do to them. And that's something to remember.
Right. Well, that's actually the type of mentality that, you know, you could use this as an example for basically anything that we talk about. But this example of this professor at the University of North Carolina, Neil Ahuja, he basically is being attacked by the media for presenting it's so contradictory, Kevin. He's being attacked for presenting an alternative opinion to the official story of 9/11 and basically the genocide that America has committed, justified by this, animalizing, if you will, of the 9/11 terrorist. Yet at the same time, as they attack him, they say the reason that this guy's crazy is because he's telling children, students of the school, that and they make it this image of children, so they play on people's heartstrings. They're attacking these kids, these young teenagers who don't know. He's attacking them and kicking them out of his class and failing them for disagreeing with him, while the media then turns around and attacks him for disagreeing with the official story. It's just – it's unbelievable to me, that kind of attack. And you're exactly right. That's what I was thinking, is that when you confront the enemy with this truth, they do panic and they start attacking, and they usually – and I think you are the best example of this. If you go online and just type in Kevin Annett, you'll probably find 50 websites that are completely full of disinformation. There's websites dedicated to me. There's a documentary that was made about me on my radio show about how I'm a disinfo agent, an hour and a half long. I didn't know that my life was that interesting.
Well, it shows you're doing something right, brother.
Yeah, I think so.
No, that's exactly – I mean, it's – you know, it's all proof of what we're talking about. And you know what? The whole thing in 9/11, September 11th to me always represented what was really a formative event in my life in 1973, the military coup in Chile, when the U.S. government brought down the Allende government because it had been nationalizing copper companies in U.S. corporate interests, and the CIA and ITT destroyed the Allende socialist government. Well, I met Chilean refugees growing up as a teenager in Vancouver who had been trying to change their society. And they came and, you know, I would speak to them. These were all refugees from 9/11, 1973, September 11th, 1973, when the coup happened. And that date was emblazoned on my memory. And when it happened in 2001, I thought, oh my God, is this poetic justice or some, or what? Right? That's what sprang to me when the so-called jets hit the tower.
That's interesting. You never told me that story before.
Yeah, it's, you know, just as it was, that coup kind of introduced me into politics when I was 17 years old. And I was thinking, if the U.S. is willing to do that to a small little country in South America, imagine what they'd do if we tried it here. But that didn't scare me. That made me all the more determined. I thought, okay, well, then look at how vulnerable they are. Look at the system, how vulnerable it is if enough of us got together. So,
That's right. I think it's also really important to understand, going back, you know, a step or two to a little bit ago, we were talking about, you know, you don't have to have a mass of people, but just a small minority, kind of like that tipping point. The only problem I see is not just educating people, because there's a lot of different groups out there, Kevin. There are groups that are concerned about geoengineering. There are groups that are concerned about genocide, groups that are concerned about GMO foods. The problem is none of those groups individually, I don't have any problems with them. The only problem I tend to have is that a lot of them are very restrictive to themselves. So if you go to a group that's concerned about, you know, I don't know, GMOs, for example, they don't want to hear anything about 9/11 or genocide. You go to a group that's concerned about, you know, weather modification, they don't want to hear anything about genocide or GMOs. And we have to understand that all of this is part of a much larger system, a much larger underlying agenda, and we have to provide people not just with education of history, but how these dots connect. Because if you see the dots connect, and you see the work that you've done with the ITCCS and the work that I've done with my radio show and working with you, and you see the dots connect along the line, for example, what you mentioned with the stepping down of Adolfo Bucan, head of the Jesuits, the stepping down of Bertolli, the stepping down of Ratzinger, all of that is related to what we've done. Yep. And if it wasn't for what we've done, those things probably wouldn't have happened. So you have to connect the dots and not see it as a simple, isolated coincidence, because it's not.
Finding the common ground. I remember back in the 70s when I first got involved in politics, people were a lot more together then. You know, prior to the internet, prior to computers and everything, we knew from face-to-face contact all the time with each other and with situations that we only had one another. We didn't have media to rely on. And we always sought at meetings, like a member would put up a poster in downtown Vancouver, 300 people would show up off the one poster. And the first thing we'd ever do at a meeting would open with music, and then we'd say, what's our common ground? What do we want? And what's our common ground? What's the common denominator that unites all of us here? And we don't hear that anymore. Everyone is split up and divided and at each other's throats now. And the internet, if anything, has made it worse. So what I think we need to get back to is that basic contact with each other and defining what is our common ground. I often say to people, there's three things. There's defense of Mother Earth, there's the defense of our children, which is our future, and the defense of our innate liberties. And if we can agree on those three and unite to defend them at all costs, then we're off to the races. And they know it. That's why a lot of the disinformation is designed to divide people and get them divided into their little issues and not see the bigger picture. providing that bigger picture is what we're all about. So unfortunately, with an hour at a time, we don't have a lot of chance to do it. But I wanted to mention to people that we're going to be starting to broadcast more audio tapes. And I don't mean videotapes, because I think visually people are distracted when they have an image to look at. We need to turn off the images and just have people listen, because then a different part of our brain is engaged. And we're going to start posting audio tapes, maybe an hour or 2 hour long. And that's the, you know, beauty of your show and my show as radio shows. People can shut their eyes and listen and take it in at a deeper level. And part of the audio tapes will be training sessions. Here's the issue. Here's how we go about it. And here's the next step. So that's going to be out, part of the work we're doing. And I want your final comments, and then I want to make a couple of announcements.
Well, I think the last thing that's on my mind today is just a reaffirmation of education. And a lot of the fracturing and divisions in society are strictly manufactured by the authoritative forces, by that father figure who tells you to be racist, who tells you there's a racial problem, when really in reality there isn't. When there really isn't a problem between all of these groups of people, a lot of it's manufactured. So we have to step away from that, stop waiting for that father figure to come out and give us permission to do something. Like actually you mentioned last week, when people are confronted with this work and what to do, the first thing they ask is, am I allowed to do that? Is that legal? You have to step outside the system. So I think it's important to remember that. The last comments I have for the program is my show, The Secret Teachings, airs every – actually, we're just going to start doing a live, hopefully live soon, but a recorded for right now, Saturday show and Sunday show. So Saturday at 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and every Sunday still 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern Standard Time on the L&M Radio Network as well as other places. All of those links, as well as I'm going to start archiving this radio show, Radio Free Kannada, on my website, thesecretteachings.info. Tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern, you can go there for the links, thesecretteachings.info. I have a four-hour show. 3 hours of it are actually about constitutional republics and rights, human liberties. And the fourth hour, I interview Freeway Rick Ross, the real Rick Ross, who was in the middle of the Iran-Contra scandal. And we talk about the shipment of drugs into minority groups and basically cultural forms of genocide and the weaponizing of the music industry. So all of that tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern. Links at thesecretteachings.info as well to BBS Radio / Radio Free Kannada.
Beautiful, Ryan. Thank you so much. And thanks again for being on. It's always a joy to have you, to be talking with you for this hour. Now, just a couple of announcements for people again. Spread the word. Go to itccs.org with the list of the places where there'll be 10 separate actions, not simply to protest and to highlight people's opposition to the Vatican and Bergoglio when he's in America, but to actually be a spiritual convergence through which our energy can reclaim the power away from Bergoglio and bring him and his institution down. It's already coming down, but we're adding the final blow, if you like. Now, that's September 23rd, 4 p.m. Be at the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C., 4 p.m. Wednesday, 23rd, when the canonization is happening. And that night, there'll be an action to stop what we understand will be the ceremonial killing of an Indian child in Washington, D.C. Also, please notify people of especially the action outside the United Nations on Friday, September 25th, 8:30 a.m., at the UN building in downtown in Harlem, south of Harlem in East Manhattan. Finally, for the folks in Sacramento who are listening in today, to remind everyone there that there will be a three-day-long workshop commencing Friday, October 30th, running through to Sunday, November 1st in Sacramento. There's a good network forming there in Northern California. I and others will be present to lead a common law workshop and direct action training at that time. And so that's to highlight that. If people want more information, write to us, republicofkannada@gmail.com. I want to thank you all for tuning in today. We will get into more of the details of this. And again, carry this on, spread the word of our show and Republic, kannadarepublic.ca.
And I have one more thing to add, Kevin, if I could.
Yes.
I would like to give to the first five people who want to email me at rdgable@yahoo.com, rdgable@yahoo.com, my book, False Prophets and the Lovers of Children. I can send them a PDF. First five people that email me, it's a history of the Vatican, child sacrifice, and all the things that we cover.
Thank you, brother. And to all of the listeners, stay tuned, stay strong, and stay clear. We'll see you next Sunday, September 13th. Thank you.
There's a man walking around the island with a snake king. Picked it up in Thailand from a hurricane. And you know he's not gonna go there. He's been one time.